Hello and welcome to the April 17th, 2024 edition of Ukraine Without Hype. I'm Anthony Bardway, and I'll be joined shortly by Romeo, along with a special guest interview with the former Democratic Party whip in the 1990s, David Bonier, who is also a community leader in the Ukrainian-American community, who is in Ukraine right now on a humanitarian and reporting trip. So that will be what most of the episode is, but first I'll do some brief news updates. Combat update-wise, the situation around Chasiv Yar is becoming more and more dire. The Russians have approached the city in three prongs, essentially. Three prongs from the north, center, and south. And while there is not yet any threat of the city being surrounded or anything like that, the Russians are beginning to approach the natural barriers around that city. So, of course, watching that space extremely closely going forward. If Chasiv Yar falls, that would put Slovyansk, Kramatorsk, that urban conglomeration, the last major urban conglomeration that's still free in Donbass, under severe threat. While the missile campaign continues, the mayor of Kharkiv said that the city is under threat of becoming, quote, the next Aleppo, referring to the city in Syria that was heavily, heavily destroyed in that country's civil war, in part by the Russian army. And as of the time of recording, there was a missile strike in central Chernihiv. Chernihiv is a city to the north of Kyiv, to the northeast. During the siege of Kyiv, Chernihiv was surrounded, and many of the towns in the area were occupied and damaged, and the people were killed and all that. So today in Chernihiv, three Russian missiles struck a central part of the city. As of right now, we know of 17 people being dead, though that may change by the time you're listening to this, and 60 injured. Missile strikes continue, and the city had very little in the way of air defense, as the air defenses for most of the country, the resources have been dwindling. Although, update on that, the Germans have said that they will be giving Ukraine another Patriot missile system. As for other forms of foreign help, we may be looking at an improvement in the situation in the United States. Up until now, the leader of the House Republicans, Michael Johnson, has refused to bring the Ukraine funding bill to the floor. It seems as though there is pressure building up on him to actually do that, only in the form of splitting that bill up so that is not Israel, Ukraine, and Taiwan funding altogether, but rather individually, so that maybe one would pass and theoretically another may not. Considering the overall votes for Ukraine aid, if they go to the floor, as we've been saying, if it goes to a floor vote of yes or no, it will in all likelihood pass. Though we have already seen Johnson and other members of the Republican Party get squirrely on that as well. There have been, you know, hundreds of statements, and as always, it's hard to tease them apart, and thank God we are not a U.S. politics podcast, because that would be unbearable. But so far we have seen, for example, Johnson trying to separate the bills but then pass them all at the same time, so functionally they'd all be one bill. We have seen more of the a much more hardcore Trumpist wing of the party react extremely violently to this idea of passing any of this aid at all, to the point where there's now a motion being passed among these hard right members of the Republican Party to get rid of Johnson entirely if he moves forward with the Ukraine aid voting. Theoretically, we're supposed to see some kind of forward movement on this week, though we have not yet. At least as of time of recording, and not much time will pass between recording and release on this one, so who knows by the time you listen. Again, there might be another change on that. Hopefully by the end of the week, there will be at least something on the floor to vote upon, but we'll see. I'll be very skeptical on that. These far-right members of the Republican Party will find a way to ruin this somehow. It's only a question of how and if they succeed in doing so. And as we did speak to, you know, the former Democrat Party whip in our interview later on in this episode, we did talk about this in that interview. So as you listen to that, that part of the information will be slightly outdated. We did ask him about separating these issues into different bills. He responded yes. It did not make about a very large part of the interview, so don't worry about that. It's not all outdated or anything like that. But as you listen to that, keep that in mind, is that as party whip, his job was to whip votes, and we did briefly touch on that, of how to get these votes together. So we'll see. We'll see. Romeo is not here for this news update, but he is much more skeptical about this than even I am. And moving on to the next topic is a large legislative push in the Ukrainian parliament, as opposed to the U.S. Congress. Last episode, we talked about one aspect of mobilization reform was that the age to draft people, to conscript people into the military, was dropped from the age of 27 to the age of 25. Since then, a much larger mobilization reform bundle has also passed. And we absolutely do not have time to go over everything in that, so I'll have to give as brief of an overview as I can. But more or less, the reason of this new mobilization law is to collect data on people that can be used for later mobilization. This mobilization law, the most recent one, had to do with people who had previously received a medical semi-exemption, like yes or no kind of thing, to go get another medical review to see if they are, you know, one or the other. You're either medically qualified or you're not. No more of this in-between stuff. There will also be other bureaucratic adjustments in order to have a broader idea of who exactly is eligible for a conscription or not. One thing that it did leave out, however, was the question of demobilization, as in when people are allowed to leave the military. There are a lot of soldiers, especially conscripted soldiers, who have been fighting for a very long time. They're exhausted and would like to get out of the military after they've been fighting so hard and for so long. Unfortunately, that does not seem to be an option now or possibly in the near future. That is a major complaint that civil society has about this bill, is that some issue of demobilization was hoped to be included in it. It had been discussed in military circles for months, and nothing materialized of that. It is also introducing new punishments for avoiding conscription, including the denial of consular services or the revocation of driver's licenses, though these issues might still be up for further review. Again, very, very dense. Don't have much time to talk about it, but that's the overall summary. In our last news update, we're going to look to Georgia, where the Georgian parliament has been trying to pass through a, quote, foreign agent law. This law would demand that organizations, NGOs, media outlets who receive more than 20% of their funding from outside of Georgia to register as, quote, agents of foreign influence. This law is mostly copy-pasted from the Russian law on the same issue, the Russian foreign agents law, and is seen by the country's opposition, civil society, and liberal political movements as a way to try and crack down on their opposition who may be receiving funding from the diaspora, from the US, from the European Union, that kind of thing. And while many countries have some version of this, where if you receive money from foreign governments especially is more common, that they have to register as such, but this thing of being labeled, quote, agents of foreign influence was used in Russia to basically crack down and virtually destroy the liberal opposition within the span of a few years. And Georgians are assuming that they're going to do the same thing there. The ruling party of Georgia, Georgia Dream, is pretty friendly with Russia. The not exactly leader of the party in a formal sense, but the actual leader of the party in a reality sense, Ivanishvili, is a Russian oligarch, essentially. Most of his money was made in Russia. His ties are to Russia. And so those who oppose him see his efforts in a very Russian lens. The mass protests against the bill have caused the voting on it to pause. However, the Prime Minister, Kabahidze, is insisting that he will get this law through, despite its extreme lack of popularity, the extreme political opposition to it. He's saying that we're going to do this. So my hopes are with the protesters, with the opposition. Georgians are very fiercely independent people. The Georgian people, of course, are some of the closest friends Ukraine has. The Georgian government is the victim of pro-Russia oligarchic capture, even as the country of Georgia is occupied, 20% of it, by Russian military forces. So resist all that you can. So now to that interview with David Bonnier. Again, keep in mind that small update to the congressional laws. So it's a very good talk, and I hope you enjoy it.
Hello, and welcome to Ukraine Without Hype. My name is Romy Kratsky, and I'm here with my colleague, Anthony Bartaway. Today, we've got a special treat for our listeners. We are going to be speaking to David Bonnier. David is a former congressperson for the northern suburbs of Detroit, and he's been involved in Ukraine policy for a very, very long time. David, thank you so much for joining us. Let's start off with the basics. How did you get involved in Ukraine? Why do you care at all?
I'm Ukrainian-American. My grandfather was born and raised until he was 18 in a place called Stetsova, which is near Sanata, in a town of about 30,000 in western Ukraine near the Romanian border. He left with two friends from his village. They were dirt poor in 1912, and they came across to the United States by ship, went up to Canada. He got married to another Ukrainian woman, my grandmother, who I never met because she died before I was born. And they came down to Detroit eventually. And he worked in an auto factory, and I lived in his house and was raised by him and, of course, my parents. We all lived together in a community called Hamtramck, which is a Ukrainian, which was then particularly a Ukrainian-Polish community and African-American community, three pieces. So I took my grandfather to Ukrainian concerts. I took him to the cultural center. I took him to picnics along the river in Detroit. Ukrainian picnics, so I was kind of immersed in Ukrainian culture through his friends and those kinds of activities.
And one thing that stuck out in your biography was back in 1991, during the period of Ukrainian independence, one thing that we do accent to our listeners is that at the time, the policy of the Bush senior administration was to kind of keep the Soviet Union together and was opposed to a lot of the independence of these various countries. But you were very much pro-independence.
Yes.
So can you describe, like, what was the change in American policy at that time in order to support these independence movements rather than keeping the status quo?
Well, there was obviously an opening with Glasnost and then eventually with the fall of communism and the Soviet Union. So there was an opening. And, of course, the Ukrainians had a short sliver of independence in the 20th century, and the opening occurred, and they wanted it, and so did, of course, the Baltics and all the other Russified places, or tried to Russify the different Eastern European nations. So people had it with Russia and the Soviet Union. They had 70 years of it, and it was enough. I was elected leader of my party, which is, as you pointed out, the Democratic Whip. It was the number two position in the House, and I was very active in issues that would have granted independence to Ukraine, which was my home, as I was active for Polish independence as well.
Did you encounter a lot of resistance to the idea that these ex-Soviet republics should be independent in the early days in the foreign policy establishment?
Foreign policy establishment, yeah, they were trying to trying a soft landing, for lack of a better word, but there was no really soft landing. People had their whole lives upended by the Soviets. And if you're a Catholic, for instance, Ukrainian, Greek Catholic, or part of the other part of the Western Church, you knew how you had to be underground. You couldn't practice your religion. It was pretty horrific in terms of liberties was concerned. And so It was a movement of for people's rights as human beings to practice the four freedoms and their religion. And, you know, there were a lot of people for it. And so I was in part of the within my caucus. We were the majority back then. I was the majority whip for, 4 or 5 years, and then minority whip for 4 years.
Yeah, so fast forwarding now, you're on a mission with a variety of experts going around Ukraine. Can you give a brief description of what your current mission is within the country?
Yeah. Last year, I wanted to get involved with, I've been out of Congress for 22 years, so I'm not, you know, I'm a former member of Congress. I started very young. I was 27 when I was elected to the legislature, 31 to the Congress, so. And then I spent 26 years and left in when I was 57 years of age. Now I'm knocking on 80, so I've been around for a while. So we came here last year, Father Peter Daly, who's a Catholic priest, and myself, good friends. I wanted to come here. I told him I was coming. I asked him if he wanted to come. He said, sure. He's great on human rights issues and just about every other progressive issue that you can think of. And so we came, and our purpose last year in 2023 was to talk to refugees and people that had lost their homes within Ukraine, and to write about them, to hear their stories, to bear witness to their suffering, hear their stories, write about their stories. And so we're both writers, and we've had probably in the last year about 13 different pieces published in national newspapers and publications. We both are writers for the National Catholic Reporter, which is a very good independent newspaper in the United States, one of the best, I think. And so I'm on that other board as well. So we have those connections, and we came and we went to Poland for a week, and then we came to Ukraine for a week. And the reason, of course, we went to Poland is because they had such a huge exodus of Ukrainians to Poland, and the Poles were absolutely incredible in terms of their welcoming and how they took them in and gave them benefits. And it was really quite amazing what Caritas, the charitable arm of the Catholic Church, did in Poland. So we did that, and we ended up going back in writing. And I went up on the hill to anticipate your next question and talk to my colleagues about what I learned, what I saw, why it's important to be supportive of Ukraine, and why it means so much that Ukraine be successful. Because I tell people in the United States, and I tell friends who are unsure about this, that this fight will either be won here in Ukraine, or we will be fighting in a NATO country, which means that U.S. citizens will be fighting as well. And so we're trying to make that point, and we're trying to make the point of that Putin is a war criminal at the highest level. What he did in Mariupol, what he's done in Bucha, which we visited on this trip, took a 3-hour tour with Lynn Weldon and her husband, who was a part of the Ukrainian military. What they did and he did there was just horrific. Putin is, a product of Stalin in the same way. You know, he wants to use food as a weapon. He also has killed mercilessly. I mean, what he did in Mariupol particularly, and in Bucha, was sadistic. 600 people in Bucha murdered, raped, and Mariupol, I just can't even talk about those horrors without including the word war criminal to those who were attached to them. So we visited with war crime investigators here, trip. We spent a lot of time this time on the trip that we started a little over a week ago on the whole question of mental health, because we realize the huge stress this war has caused, particularly in trauma that it's caused, particularly for children, combatants, and also caregivers, especially women. And we want to tell their stories. We want to help bring aid to their communities. And we learned of a lot of programs that are ongoing, starting up. We've got programs in the U.S. that can be helpful here. So we're trying to connect people so they can talk to the right people in the U.S. to get the aid and assistance that they need. That's why we did this trip, yeah. And we're not, you know, we did this on just on our own. We're not sponsored by any organization. We just decided we want to do it. And I asked a few people, and after we had such a good trip last year in terms of actually getting things done, we decided to do it and expand it. So we have a doctor, a psychiatrist from University of Washington, who's also professors on this trip. We have another one from Buku from Grand Rapids, Michigan, who is on this trip. He teaches there, as well as Emily Rutkowski, who used to be a constituent of mine when she was very small. Now she's a woman who's doing great leadership work. She's a lawyer, but she decided to give all that up and come here and work. And they're working for nothing. We were with people yesterday at a camp. I can't tell you where it is, but the training camp. We saw them being trained for combat. And there are five fellas that served in the Legion, International Legion, fighting with the Ukrainians. That are now trainers. They don't get paid or anything, but they're here doing it. I'm going to try to help and get some resources because, you know, you got to have some money to live on while you're here. So, and they're just fabulous people. They care about democracy. They care about the people of Ukraine, and I do too. So we're going to try to make this a better place, and hopefully we can withstand the what's happening right now.
The advocacy efforts that you've been involved with are incredibly admirable. But in light of, let's say, the not total or not completely enthusiastic support that the U.S. government has provided Ukraine, how have your colleagues or former colleagues on the Hill taken to your activism, to your advocacy? Have they been receptive? We've seen a lot of obstructionism, especially from.
Yeah. But it's just from a sliver of people. I mean, the bill that has Ukrainian aid passed in the Senate with 70 votes. And in the House, if they get a vote in the next week or two, which I'm hopeful that they will get, that would be 300 votes out of 400. So there's a lot of exaggeration in terms of there's not enough support. And if you get the vote up, the Speaker brings it up, Mr. Johnson. It depends how he forms it, though. It will get the votes that it needs to get signed by the president. So,
do you think that Ukrainians' kind of feeling of resentment or being left behind by the U.S. political establishment, do you think that's like an accurate or a helpful sentiment for Ukrainians to hold?
Well, I can understand it. And we all can understand it because nobody likes to feel like they've been betrayed. But it's a betrayal of basically the Republican Party. And not all Republicans, though. We're going to get 100 Republican votes and virtually all Democratic votes, unless it's tied in a way with Gaza that will inhibit some from voting for it. On the Democratic side, so we don't know what form and shape it's going to take, but my sense is that we're going to get this done. Too late. It should have been done 6 months ago, but we're doing the best we can with what we're working with. You know, elections have consequences, and the American people decided to elect a Republican Congress in the House, not by very much, like 2 votes. Actually, out of 435, they are in control. And we're hopeful that they will not be in control come November.
As your experience as party whip, though, you mentioned it being tied to Gaza. And so far, Ukraine funding has been tied to Israel funding, has been tied to border funding.
Yeah.
Taiwan funding as well, but Taiwan is less problematic as a vote getter, right. I feel. So do you think that it being attached to these other issues is a mistake? And if it is going to have to be attached to these issues, how can they get support from Democrats who would be opposed to these other things that it's tied to?
Well, it would be better if they were separated and they voted on them individually, I think, to let everybody express themselves according to their views and beliefs on it. But we don't know. It depends on how the Speaker, who is in control of the Rules Committee, which decides the rules in which the bill is debated upon, how he's going to do this. And he's in discussions evidently now, and we'll know within a week or so. And hopefully within the next 2 weeks, we'll have a bill and we'll see how the votes go and what happens.
Speaking of democracy and the House, a lot of Ukrainians that I spoke to have, as I mentioned, a pretty negative outlook on U.S. support and aid. And a lot of them seem to be kind of resigned to the idea that Donald Trump will be elected once again to be president. And they seem to believe that U.S. policy will not drastically change in regards to Ukraine, even if Trump is president. Some people I've talked to even see it as a positive for some reason. Now, this is not a podcast where we hide our inclinations. I'm a Democrat. I am heavily opposed to Donald Trump, and I believe his election would spell doom for not only Ukraine, but for most of the world.
NATO, the world, yeah. So we don't know what's going
on. What would you say to these Ukrainians who think a Trump presidency might not be as bad or might not change much in terms of Ukraine policy?
Well, listen to what he says on Ukraine, and he's opposed to funding and supporting Ukraine. So that ought to tell you something and tell them something. Democracy is not easy, and it's complicated. And an autocracy is a lot more simple, and it's easier to think in terms of when your model is an autocratic one as opposed to a democratic one. So the people will make those judgments and assumptions, but the fact of the matter is that Ukraine's best friend has been the United States up until recently, and it will be again, I think, once we get this aid package back on track.
And the last thing I worry about a lot is, so you are Ukrainian-American, you used to represent Warren, which was kind of the center point of Ukrainian-Americans in Michigan, at least. That's where the community center is and all that. I've been there before. One worry that people have is that a lot of the Ukrainian-American community has traditionally been Republican, and that in a lot of ways they haven't changed their minds on the Republican Party, even with Republican resistance to support for Ukraine. So do you feel any of that changing in the Ukrainian-American community?
Regretfully, I don't feel it's changing. And I think they have, many in the Ukrainian-American community have given up on their country, I think. I'm disappointed at the lack of support that's come out of that community, at least in Michigan, in my old district. When I was in Congress, we had some great people like Vera Antoshevich, who was Wayne State person, wonderful, the leader in the community. Steve Vicar, great people, but I don't know what's happened. Democracies have to sustain themselves by activism and education and all these pieces. So they could be doing more, and they ought to be ashamed of themselves for not doing more, providing resources, providing money, encouragement, education. And so I hope they will understand that this is about whether they're going to go back to an autocracy the way their ancestors and some of them lived for 70 years. Is that what they want again? Donald Trump is very close to Putin. So they need to wake up. And if they don't wake up, which they may not do because they are sleeping right now, there's problems ahead.
So we're kind of closing in on your time here. So I want to ask you, especially regarding your trip here, what message do you want to get out generally to our listeners and to former constituents? Like, what's your thesis statement here about Ukraine?
Ukraine is a beautiful country with magnificent people. They're resilient. They're smart. They're tough. They're taking on a world power, probably the second most important power militarily in the world. And it's an even battle right now. And that requires some admiration. They have a leader who is sort of the envy of the world in terms of his skills, his commitment to democracy and justice. And is Ukraine perfect? No. Is the United States perfect? No. So, but you have to work with, well, do you want to work with another Russia like the Soviet Union? You want to work with Putin? That's your choice here. And I think people will come to their senses. I tend to be an optimist that when November comes around, that Trump will get beat, the aid will flow, and the Ukrainians will be on the march again to get some of their territory back.
It's honestly, it's to me, it's not a choice. The question of, do you want to live in a freer, more liberal, more human world, or do you want to live at the whim of some kleptocratic asshole? It's never been much of a question to me. And to be honest, it boggles the mind that people can look at that question and say, you know what? No, I want to be ruled by a bunch of mafiosos and thieves. But hopefully, with advocacy like you and your fellows promote that will eventually change, especially in regards to the diaspora. I just want to say thank you very much for your time.
It's been an honor to speak to you. Appreciate your getting the message out to people, and thank you so much.
All right, so thank you very much for talking to us, and until next week, Slava Ukraini.
Heroim Slava.
So that was our interview with the former party whip at the Democratic Party, 1990s, David Bonnier. I hope you all took something out of that. He's a great source of information and really insight into the historical relationship between the United States and independent Ukraine. But time to close out the episode. So if you would like to support Ukraine, contact your congresspeople. I don't know where that's leading right now, this week or next week, but put the spurs to them if you can. If you'd like to support Ukraine more broadly, you can also look at our link tree in the description for a list of charities and information resources about the country. If you'd like to support Ukraine Without Hype, please rate us, like us, subscribe, tell your friends, your family, spread the word. And those likes and comments really help us in the algorithm. If you'd like to support us financially, you can go to patreon.com/UkraineWithoutHype. And join one of our tiers of support, including the access to our Discord server. So now I'd like to thank all of our wonderful patrons who keep us going. So thank you very much to Deborah Grazer, Randy McNerlin. The voices in my head are from Big Pharma, David Shepard, Giorgio, Ivana Kukratskaya, Michael Drucker, Anna Karen Person, Anonymous, Dennis Napalm, Devi, Dimitri Litvin, Etienne, James Burke, Jan, Yunara, Jenny Louise, Kevin Alberton, Marguerite, Michael Wickman, Mike Perrone, P.L. Shieldwall, Silas Frank, T. Bart, Vivek, Adam Poppenheimer, Aiden McDonald, Alex Grochmal, Anastasia, Barbara, Captain Technical, Chris Bennington, Daniel Spring, David Wall, Emily Pavona, Francois, Grace Krause, Had to Laugh, Jacob Holm, James Wise, Jared Bradley, Jared, Julia Lindsay, Laura De Leon, Laurie, Alila, Levy Grove, Marianne, Matt Miller, Lisa Kaselko, Anonymous, Noam Hart, Paul Bailey, RDK, Sanjay, Scott Barry, Scott Gengris, Scott Torkiuk, Stuart Akers, Subtle Knife, Thomas Soviak, Veronica, Victoria Leontineva, and Wandering Lens. Thank you all very much for your support. We're at Make This All Possible. So until next week, Slava Ukraini.